Thank you very much, Vice Chancellor, and thanks to all of you for taking the trouble to give up your Tuesday evening to come and hear me talk, and talk to a title which self-evidently has a certain rhetorical quality to it, because I wouldn't use a title like that unless I was going to suggest that scientists and policymakers haven't always been honest with each other and with the public, and I want to talk about the conditions under which we might move to a set of arrangements that are more honest than they have been hitherto. But I guess the Vice-Chancellor has been kind enough to reveal some of my my biography, so I can keep the anecdote short. But I am indeed addressing a topic today of the sort that I frequently address, which is irredeemably and unavoidably interdisciplinary. It's a very long time since I have worked within the confines of traditional subject disciplines, and this is because, as far as I can see it, the real world doesn't present problems to us neatly tied up within the circumscribed boundaries of disciplines, and the kind of work my colleagues and I at the Science Policy Research Unit in Sprue do is we draw upon disciplines in order to illuminate problems in the world, which involves bringing many disciplines together and making the connections between them. And the topic I'm drawing on, though, is connected to this rather eccentric education I've enjoyed. I did indeed go to university to study physics. I could do sums and experiments, but I wasn't terribly good at reading and writing. And so I was told I would be a scientist and was put on a conveyor belt, and I went to the university enthusiastically to do a physics degree. But I had remarkably good fortune. I went to the University of Kent at Canterbury the year it had opened, and nothing had been established other than some courses, but it was completely novel, which is splendidly refreshing. And, well, there was this notice on a notice board in the first week saying, if you want to start a club or society and you need money for equipment, go and see this particular chap. And it might not be obvious by looking at me at the moment, but in fact, as a teenager, I'd done quite a lot of judo, and with fellow students, we wanted to start a judo club, and concrete's not a terribly good surface for doing it on, so we wanted mats, so we needed whatever it was, a few hundred pounds for mats. So I went and knocked on this chap's door at 5 o'clock one evening after my last lecture, because as a science student, there were lectures from 9 to 5, 5 days a week for 3 years, and laboratories. But anyway, I knocked on this gentleman's door, and he invited me in and asked me what I come for. I explained about the mats and the judo. He said, how much? I told him, he said, certainly. That conversation was ended. And he said to me, what are you doing here? And I said, I've come to study physics. And in a sort of inept attempt to create conversation, I responded, and what do you do? And he said, I teach philosophy. And I don't think I'd ever heard that word before. So I said to him, what's that? And this was about, so this had got us to about 5:10 that evening. And my recollection is that we stayed there until maybe 3 the next morning, talking about philosophy. And we became the closest of friends, and he would be here today, but for the fact that his wife has got a bad infection and they can't leave home. They're still in Canterbury. But I owe an enormous debt of gratitude to Chris Cherry in the philosophy department of Kent University. And one of the many, many things I got from Chris was a clear encouragement to ask and address difficult questions that lots of people don't want to ask and choose to avoid. And the kinds of questions I have pursued subsequently have been of this character. So while doing physics, yes, the way I like to put it is I succumb to a severe attack of philosophy, from which I have almost complete remission of symptoms, but it took quite a few years for me to recover. But I was studying as a postgraduate in London, trying to get posts in philosophy, but I hadn't been to Oxford or Cambridge, and I didn't go to a public school, so that didn't seem open. And then I applied for this post at Sussex to teach history and philosophy and sociology of science. I knew something about the history of science, I knew quite a bit about the philosophy of science, but I knew nothing about the sociology of science. but through a remarkable process, which I won't bore you with, they appointed me in the summer of 73 to a post to teach history and philosophy of science. And when I came here, one of the many topics I knew nothing about, and it was a very long list, but one of the many topics I knew nothing about was science policy. I'd not even heard of it. I didn't know it existed. But I encountered it when I came to Sussex. But what happened was, I was teaching away here at Sussex, teaching history and philosophy of science, and, oh yeah, no, I brought it with me. My life was changed. A fellow graduate student in philosophy introduced me to the New York Review of Books. And in March 74, this copy of the New York Review of Books arrived through the post. And there was an article in it called Death for Dinner. There's a photograph of it by Daniel Sverdling. And it was a review of several books written by Americans about the US food industry, alleging in particular the food industry was undermining the health of the American consumer by selling them food that had diminished nutritional quality, added chemicals and contaminants, and loaded with fats and sugars in ways that was not good for US public health. And I don't know what came over me, because I was incredibly apolitical then, but for some reason that I can't quite recall, I took a photocopy of the piece and I found which department of the Ministry of Agriculture, Fisheries and Food dealt with these kinds of problems and sent it to them and asked for discussion. And I was expecting that one or two people might chat to me, and I expected them to say, oh, don't worry, that's only in the US. Everything here is completely different. You know, the government is making sure that everything we're eating is splendidly good for us. But that wasn't what happened. I eventually got an appointment. I was invited up to the Min of Ag, Fish and Food and then kept waiting in an anteroom for 3 hours and then summoned into a room which had, I think, 7 or 9 people in a line. Only the one in the middle spoke. And there was a chair in front of them, like for the naughty schoolboy. And I was told to sit there. And only the one in the middle, as I say, spoke. And I paraphrase only slightly. He said, go away, little man, and get your nose out of our business. Now, if he'd said something different, I would have gone off and looked at the history of thermodynamics and steam engine design or something. But I was so taken aback by this, I stumbled out into Whitehall, sat down in a coffee bar, got myself a drink, and thought, these people have got something to hide. And I started to dig and dig and dig and gather everything I could on food and health. And shortly after met my good friend Tim Lang, who I'm delighted to see here, and 3 or 4 other people. And at the time in the mid-70s, it seemed to us that they were, interesting though food and health was, and food policy, it was unlikely that there ever would be more than about 7 people on the planet who would think that food and policy or food and health were interesting issues. We just seemed to be digging away. But the more I dug, the more convinced I became that there was something to hide. Now, which pocket have I put? Oh, no, it's here. Right. Okay. So I dug it, and I dug, first of all, into food additives. I gathered enormous amounts of information on food toxicology. In particular, was reading volumes and volumes of results of the tests of chemicals on rats and mice that we cited as grounds for saying these things were acceptable. Whereas a few other people, particularly in North America, and particularly one of the authors of one of the books reviewed in the New York Review, Mike Jacobson, the Center for Science and the Public Interest, said, sometimes they're not very good for rats and mice, so maybe they're not good for people. Anyway, I kind of puzzled away at this for about 10 years in a more or less solitary fashion, and then eventually plucked up courage to go to a food science conference, and I found myself at coffee break on the first morning standing next to Britain's then premier professor of toxicology, and I asked him the question that had been puzzling me for years. I said to him, what's the relevance of mice and rats to humans? And he gave me an answer I didn't expect. perhaps the answer I least expected, his answer was, "Your guess is as good as mine." Which I interpreted to mean, actually, there's something rather problematic about the way in which this evidence is interpreted. And this provided the basis for a book on additives, and then I'd worked on pesticides, and then genetic and engineering, lead toxicity, BSE, numerous topics, from which I've developed a sort of generic analysis, one level of going up a level of generality, about how scientific evidence has been used in policy making, what's problematic about it, and how it ought to change, and that's what I want to do today. All right. Okay. So this is the question. How do science and politics interact in policy making? And are they separated? And can they be separated? And what is a legitimate arrangement between them? And it's not difficult to see why that arrangement might seem problematic, because, of course, the criteria of truth in science and criteria of acceptability in politics are radically different. I mean, even if at the time when everyone thought that the Earth was stationary at the center of the universe, that didn't make it so. And if we all vote for the existence of creatures from outer space, that doesn't make it so. So science is not determined in a democratic way. But democratic decisions are not reached by calculation or experimentation. It's entirely different. And some have argued, philosophers and historians and policy analysts have argued, not just that scientific legitimacy and political legitimacy are different, but they're fundamentally inconsistent and cannot be reconciled. And my argument is that that is not correct, that they can be reconciled. They are often in conflict, but there are certain conditions in which they can legitimately be coupled together, and that's what I'm going to talk about. And I don't know why that's dropped. So let's move on. Okay. I'm not talking about everything in politics, I'm not talking everything about science, but the domain I wish to discuss is the use of scientific evidence as it's invoked as a basis for making regulatory decisions about industrial technologies, whether that's mobile telephones, pharmaceutical products, chemicals in the food supply, cosmetics, paints, industrial, or even the safety of offshore oil drilling facilities. Typically, policy makers turn to scientists, to expert advisors, and I'm interested in the role that they play. Yes, Eva. This slide sort of hints at the answer I'm going to give at the end, which is, if scientists were legitimately to confine themselves to scientific information and considerations alone, and if they avoided venturing into non-scientific political territory, they wouldn't be in a position to give ministers, government policymakers, what my good friend and colleague Andy Stirling calls monolithic prescriptive advice, or they shouldn't give advice that says, follow this course of action. When you give singular prescriptive advice, I'm arguing, you're always making some prior non-scientific assumption. If you stick to the science, all you can say is about what we know and don't know about the consequences of following or failing to follow a range of different courses of action. So legitimate scientific advice to policymaking ought to be plural and conditional, not monolithic and prescriptive. But that's often not what happens. And, wait a minute. Oh, no, okay, let's skip some slides and come to the meat of this. What I want is to offer, as it were, both an analytic and chronological framework of different ways of trying to make sense of the relationship between expert advice and scientific expertise and advice in policy making. And I want to start from a model that was developed in on the continent in the late 19th century by Weber and Durkheim. And they realized, having been born in essentially pre-industrial society and grown up through the Industrial Revolution and found themselves as adults and professors in a fully industrialized society, quite different from that in which they grew up, they saw the society they grew up in as increasingly bureaucratized and bureaucracies as necessary for a modern industrial state, but not so for an agricultural society. And they were interested in what role should the bureaucrats, or in this context, the experts, have in deciding policy making. And they articulated what I think of, going back to my philosophy, is essentially a sort of Aristotelian view, which is that the process is in two stages, goals, ends and means. Now, those of you who are less colorblind than I will see that the topic, which the issues that I portray as political, I'm indicating with the warmth of red, and science, in fact, with a cool blue color. And this was sort of classical view articulated in the 19th century, that I say has prior earlier resonances, which was that policymakers decide what it is that they're trying to achieve, and bureaucrats and experts have a subsequent downstream role in deciding the most effective means to achieve the goals that the policymakers set. So the experts and advisors and the bureaucrats are always subordinate to the policymakers, and the policymakers set the goals, and the experts are limited to identifying means. Now, there's some interesting insights in this model, but it has its serious limitations, and the limitations which were evident in the 19th century, because in particular in France, the positivists and technocrats were saying, hang on, in a rapidly changing industrial society, policymakers, what do they know about what are the problems that need solutions? What are the problems that need to be addressed? I mean, to take a more recent 20th century analogy, if it wasn't for the scientists telling the policymakers that climate change was really important or there was a hole in the ozone layer, they wouldn't know that steps needed to be taken to try to address this. So this model might have worked in a constant, old-fashioned pre-industrial society, but in a rapidly changing technological society, it just won't do. And so what came developed was, as well, there were a technocratic critique that said, essentially what is appropriate is to give the full responsibility for both choosing ends and means to the experts. A technocratic view which claimed that really only the experts know what the problems are, what can be done about it, and policy should be handed over from policymakers to scientists and other experts, and let the experts decide. I mean, you know, it's very Platonic. The philosopher king should run the world. But excuse me. And this model, though it has its origins in the 19th century, became very popular, particularly in Britain and Europe, after the Second World War. Let me give you an example. Many of you may have been in this country and followed the news during the BSE saga from 86 to 96. And how many times did ministers stand up in the House of Commons and say, we are doing what and only what our experts tell us. It is not for me as a mere politician to second guess the experts. They know what the problems are. They know what the risks are. They know what the options are. My job is simply to select the best experts and implement their advice. And you know, that rhetoric is exceedingly attractive to policymakers. Now, I don't repeat gossip, so I'll say this only once. when the Food Standards Agency was established, the first chair of the board in this country was Professor John Krebs, an Oxford professor of zoology. What more could be done to portray the policies coming out of the board as putting a professor of science, a science professor at the head? And it was a curious institution. It is a curious institution. I mean, when my good friend Tim and I, with Phil James, wrote the proposal for Blair on setting up the Food Standards Agency, we recommended that the agency would advise and ministers would decide. But that's not what happened. That was what they proposed in the initial white paper, but somewhere twixt white paper and legislation, it mutated so that ministers retreated and decide nothing. All of the decisions on both policy and science are included within the Food Standards Agency. So when John Krebs was appointed, he was invited in by the then Secretary of State for Health, Frank Dobson, and I wasn't in the room, but I'm reliably given to understand that Dobson's opening gambit was, "Professor, I want you to realize that I shall never hesitate to use you as my shield." Now, if you'd said that to me, I'd have said, "Thanks, Frank, find some other mug for the job." Krebs was happy to take it on. But what that conveys to me is not that food safety policy, for example, is a purely technical matter, but ministers are terribly keen on portraying it as if it were a purely technical matter, and that they simply do what the experts tell them, and they personally are not responsible. I mean, when the Food Standards Agency was set up, some naive amongst us thought it was there to protect public health. But it turns out it's actually there to protect ministers from the responsibility for taking difficult decisions. And this invokes a kind of technocratic narrative. Oh, and it's not gone away. Oh, yes. Yeah. It's all based on sound science. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. So here's another example of it. This was Blair sacked. What was his name? Michael Meacher, thank you, Tim. Michael Meacher as Environment Minister, and the next opportunity Meacher had in the House to ask a question at Prime Minister's Question Lab, he asked a question about GM food, and this is what Blair said, and I will resist the temptation to imitate the voice, but he said, "I think it's important for us to take on board all the issues. The only thing I would say is the whole debate must be conducted on the basis of scientific evidence, not prejudice." And then proceeded to disclose his prejudices. You know, "The biotech industry in this country is immensely important. I worry that people don't give enough consideration to the benefits." I mean, whatever this is, it's a political, economic judgment, not a scientific and technical judgment. Actually, it was a singularly ill-informed one, because back in the early 90s, UK biotech companies had decided that they would stay out of the high-volume, low-margin agricultural biotech business and leave that to the Americans, and instead concentrate on the small-volume, high-margin pharmaceutical industry, which is what they have done. And actually, that isn't what... So Blair actually misunderstood what UK and Europe's biotech industries were doing at the time. But at any rate, it says, you know, let's be scientific. Let everyone else be scientific, but, you know, let me slide across the boundary and articulate my political prejudices. But one of the reasons why I'm so critical of those kinds of narratives, I say here, is that those who articulate those narratives most enthusiastically were often those best placed to know how misleading they are. Yes. Let's say that quick. Okay. But that model, the technocratic model of science-based policymaking is just hopelessly misleading and cannot account for how in practice decisions are made, because it assumes that science speaks univocally, with one voice, as if there is no scientific uncertainty and there's no contest amongst scientists as if they were always in agreement on everything. Of course, life would be simple if that were the case, but it isn't. The science is incredibly uncertain. I mean, from 86 or 84 even, through until the spring of 96, nobody knew whether or not it was possible for human beings to succumb to Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease as a consequence of being exposed to material from BSE. We didn't know one way or the other. Nonetheless, ministers repeatedly said, it's absolutely impossible, it couldn't. Yeah, I mean, for a long time, chlorofluorocarbons were introduced because they were chemically inert. The discoverers and the developers claimed that they would therefore be environmentally completely benign because they'd never react with anything. But it is, in fact, that very stability that accounts for the role they play, their long-lasting catalytic effect in breaking down ozone up in the ozone layer. Oh, yes, this is. I'll tell you the saccharin story. How are we doing for time? Okay. That clock appears to have stopped. Okay. My grandmother's clock is still, watch is still working. I stumbled across this piece of information about 25 years ago, and what I find so extraordinary is the numbers of blind eyes that have been turned to it. Saccharin's been in use since about 1892. There have been debates about its safety since about 1893. But since about 1976, the debate has essentially focused on the issue of whether or not it's carcinogenic, because it was clear that in a particular animal study, when fed particularly over two generations, at not particularly heroic doses, saccharin increased the incidence of cancer in the bladders of male rats, but not female rats. And actually, in different varieties of rats, it did cause tumours, but at different sites, and in the females, but not the males. And similarly, if you look, when you looked at mice or guinea pigs and different varieties of different species, you got increasingly diverse results. And so, well, there are other forms of tests you can do. For carcinogenicity, you can dose populations of bacteria in glass dishes, so-called in vitro tests, put a drop of chemical in there and see whether, over the short term, it damages the genetic material in the nucleus of cells, and if it does, it's said to be genotoxic. It's toxic to the genes, which is undesirable in itself, but also can thereby initiate the formation of tumours, so it might also be carcinogenic. So we've got evidence from bacteria. The trouble is there are lots of bacteria, different kinds of bacteria, and you can grow them and cultivate them in lots of different kinds of media with different soup to feed on, and you get different answers from different test systems. So they said, all right, we'll look at humans, we'll do the epidemiological work, we'll look at population of people with diabetes. They're more likely to have used artificial sweeteners than sugar. Have they got high rates of bladder cancer? Well, maybe they have, but maybe it's due to the diabetes, not the saccharin. Or you could look at men with bladder cancer and see whether they had higher rates of having consumed saccharin. So there were what had accumulated in these three areas of animal studies, bacterial studies, and human epidemiology, increasing amounts of data, which were leaving the US government in terrible quandary as to what to make of this. So they said to the US National Academy of Sciences, please can you tell us, make sense of all this volumes of data. And the National Academy of Sciences set out to put an upper and lower bound on the risk. What could worst case scenario and best case scenario? And they came back and said, if the US population continues to consume saccharin at the rate they were then, within the US population over the next 70 years, which is, you know, an average life expectancy, they may have as few as 0.22 cases, which corresponds to one case in the US population in about 300 years. Or it may be 1,144,000. It's in there somewhere. It's not worse. It's probably not worse than that, and it's probably not better than that. But beyond that, we can't say. Now, I'm not saying, and I don't know whether, as it were, the uncertainty attending to our assessment of the risks of saccharin are greater than those for most other compounds, or whether this is simply a case in which an attempt has been made to document that uncertainty. But if science is in, if the right answer is in there somewhere, that doesn't exactly tell the policymakers what to do. If that, if the answer's at that end, it's a serious risk. If at this end, forget it. You know, you've got so many more important things to look at. So, you know, science is not certain, does not speak with one voice. And not, you know, there are innumerable ways of illustrating that, but that was just one example. But even if the science was certain, so the philosophers like to say, per impossibile, if we could not just diminish but eradicate the uncertainties, it would still not decide what we should do. Because the judgment about what is to be done is not simply about the quantitative magnitude of risk. It's about trade-offs between risks and benefits. Would we accept a risk, small though it might be, and uncertainties, large though they might be, in exchange for the role that artificial sweeteners are assumed to have in resulting in a reduction in sugar consumption? I'm working away on a separate project in which shows that as artificial sweetener consumption has risen sharply, there's been no corresponding decline in sugar. But that's not a topic I've got time to discuss today. But essentially, even if you have all the facts, and they're all entirely certain, that will not tell you what to do. To hark back to the vocabulary that I acquired as a philosophy graduate student, you can't infer an ought from an is, or even a large pile of facts and is-is. It's about acceptability of risk. And it involves what the World Trade Organization's appellate body has referred to as the chosen level of protection. Government, a policy decision has to be made about how safe is sufficiently safe. You know, last couple of weeks ago, there's this wonderful case study to be done looking at what level of volcanic ash concentration is it acceptably safe to fly jet aircraft? You know, that was guesswork. And if the only acceptable level of ash was zero, no jets would ever fly, because the, you know, there is volcanic ash in all of the atmosphere all of the time, albeit at rather low levels. And so different countries make different judgments about what's the chosen level of protection. So the technocratic model was hole below the waterline. And so an alternative was developed. There's a more complicated historical story to that, which I won't bore you with, but let me come on to what is the new dominant orthodox view, which was developed in the USA in the 1980s, adopted in Europe and in the 90s and in the World Trade Organization, the European Commission, is the framework within which the regulation of technologies is represented around the world in almost all jurisdictions. And it is now an acknowledgement that science on its own is not sufficient. Yes, there are these judgments about acceptability. And the way in which policymaking is now represented typically is as if first the scientists speak. So it's the inverse of that initial Weberian Durkheim model. First, scientists conduct what is called a risk assessment. And that judgment is then passed on to risk managers, who make decisions about what is to be done. So these are policymakers, those are experts, and the experts just rely on facts. But policymakers, of course, know about values and interests and practicalities. I mean, you know, we know that lead is toxic, and indeed there's no such thing as a desirable level of lead in the human body other than zero, as far as we can tell. And if you live in a place like Brighton or Lewis, or, you know, where there is a great deal of pre-1970s housing, most of the white gloss paint in our housing stock was lead-based through the 19th century, much of the 20th century, until the 1960s. And indeed, it was, you know, in dry weight, it's about 60% lead. You know. But the costs of taking it all away and cleaning it up safely are astronomically high. So we have judgments have to be made about, you know, practically what can be done, what can we afford, what's an acceptable cost to bear to diminish the risk, what's an acceptable set of measures to deal with it. So there are policymaking is usually portrayed as science first, policy afterwards, and then you tell the people what is to be done. But a distinctive feature of this model is that this arrow points only one way, because it portrays science informing politics, but politics does not inform the science. Science is portrayed as operating in a value-free, politics-free, socially neutral space, drawing upon and only upon the facts. And this is the modern representation, and it's embodied institutionally in expert advisory committees that advise the minister that then issue legislation and regulations, which are some of the time enforced and implemented and complied with. Now, this model's problematic in a variety of ways, one of which is it doesn't really cope terribly comfortably with the uncertainty in the science. So there isn't one arrow, as it were. I could represent that as multiple arrows with multiple conflicting, competing representations between which policymakers might have to choose. But it also inadequately characterizes what goes on in a scientific risk assessment. Because even though they are routinely portrayed as if they were purely scientific and in no way influenced by any non-scientific, normative, commercial, political consideration, I think that's a serious misrepresentation, ways that I have about 20 minutes left in which to explain. Oh, yeah. I mean, in order for scientists to make some judgment about, you know, risk or safety or acceptability of a technology, they have to draw on some assumptions which are themselves not scientific about what counts as a relevant risk. Okay, I'll give you an example. For years, food additives have been assessed purely in terms of their toxicity. Are they or are they not poisonous? And of course, this is a relevant consideration. We don't want to have toxic food additives, but that might not be the only consideration. The major public health foodborne risks these days in our society is obesity. Obesity is a serious public food-related public health problem, and one of the reasons why obesity has been rising in our society is that the fat content of our diets has been rising, increasing amounts of oils and fats, and one of the reasons that have enabled that to happen has been the food industry, in making processed foods, have increasingly relied on emulsifiers, which have enabled them to make all kinds of cakes, biscuits, dessert products, ready meals that hold oil and fat. I mean, if you had margarine without the emulsifier in it, it would separate into two layers, one of water and one with the oil floating on top. Emulsifiers hold the thing together as an even mixture. But when the role of food emulsifiers in our diet, for public health, the risks of emulsifiers are considered, they only ask the question, are they toxic or not? And frankly, I've never seen evidence that an emulsifier is toxic, as far as I can see. This is a rare admission for me, but I see no evidence that they're toxic. But I think they're having a huge impact on public health. But that is outside the frame, partly because the only experts who are asked are toxicologists. They don't ask nutritionists. They're not on the committee. It's a toxicity committee. It's framed by certain assumptions about what's relevant, what's a relevant risk. Yeah, in North America, where I'm flying tomorrow, most livestock is treated with synthetic hormones that promote the rate of growth, that get them to put weight on more rapidly than otherwise, because they put these capsules or pellets of synthetic hormones under the skin, and it dissolves and it stimulates the absorption and metabolism of food. Now, we don't permit that in the UK or Europe, and the Americans do. And the Americans are furious about this because it means Europeans won't import US beef. The US beef industry wants to sell its beef in Europe, and it's banned in Europe. And the Americans took the Europeans to a dispute at the World Trade Organization, which initially the Europeans lost, but they went through the process again. They said, no, hang on. The risks that the Americans assess when they look at beef hormones is whether or not beef and poultry and pork are acceptably safe for the average healthy adult male. What about females? What about young people? What about prepubescent people? What about elderly people? What about people who are immunologically compromised? They may be safe for the average healthy adult male, but when you look at other groups in society, other target groups, you find that there are grounds for thinking that they may not be safe. They pose risks. And on that basis, Europe now keeps them out and without getting in a dispute. But deciding what counts as a risk and what's a relevant group, that determines which questions you ask of the experts and influences which answer they give. But the choice of question is not itself a scientific question. I'll give you another example. Thankfully, no one's mobile phone has gone off, but that would have given me an opportunity to say this. Okay, we'll want to be sure that mobile telephones are acceptably safe, both to use and the base stations with which they communicate. And we want those risks assessed, and we're told they're entirely safe. But it turns out that the only risks of mobile telephones that are officially and formally assessed are thermal effects. I mean, mobile phones emit and receive microwave energy. You know, most of us are reluctant to put our heads in a microwave oven, turn the power on. We don't want a blast of microwaves, but the levels are quite low. But the conclusion is that the heating effect, the thermal effect of having a mobile phone next to your head, is less than the effect of putting a hat on or taking a hat off, and therefore that's acceptably safe. And so, well, that's reassuring. But actually, microwaves can exert not only thermal effects, they might exert electromagnetic effects. It is, after all, electromagnetic energy. But that's beyond the scope of the official discussion of risk. It's not assessed because it's deemed implicitly, not explicitly, to be outside the scope. But deciding the scope is, as I say, delineating the questions that the scientists address, but the choice of question is not itself a scientific question, a scientific issue. It's a policy question about science. So, Howard, let's move. Oh, yeah, okay. Something quite extraordinary happened a few years ago, which is, okay, the previous model I put up gives you the current orthodoxy, but there's been a crack in the orthodoxy, which I find quite fascinating, and it's a crack that emerged in an obscure organization, at least obscure if you're not working in or about the food industry, and it's an organization called CODEX, or the Codex Alimentarius Commission. And this is a joint organization of the World Health Organization, UN Food and Agriculture Organization, which sets standards for internationally traded food commodities. And they had been using that orthodox science first, politics second model for many years, but in 2003, through a process that I have not yet managed to nail down, but I'm working on it, there was this extraordinary acknowledgement that actually the questions that these experts address and answer depends upon prior upstream policy assumptions of a non-scientific sort, and Codex gave it a name. They call it risk assessment policy. What is the policy that comes before the science, not just after it? And, oh yeah. So, this is a representation of the model which I think more accurately portrays what actually goes on in policymaking, even though it's not the way in which it's usually represented. So, the previous model simply had experts, scientists, with a singular arrow in that direction advising policymakers. But I'm saying in practice, the deliberations of experts are themselves framed by prior non-scientific assumptions about what counts as a risk, what counts as relevant evidence. For several years, people such as myself, we call them framing assumptions, but now Codex calls them risk assessment policy, but they're referring to the same thing. And now it portrays science not as operating in a political vacuum, which was always an unrealistic portrayal, but it is, as it were, it plays an important role, but it's sandwiched between two discrete sets of non-scientific considerations. One set upstream, which sets the agenda for the science, and one downstream of the sort I was referring to previously about trade-offs between risks and benefits and judgments of acceptability. And now the arrows go both ways, by which I mean the experts have something to say to the policymakers about what the question should be. Indeed, I think it's remiss of the nutritionists not to have drawn the policymakers' attention, for example, to the potential role of emulsifiers in the causation of obesity. They should have done, but they haven't been doing so. But the responsibility for deciding what the question is to be is one that should be decided by policymakers, not by scientists. Part of my claim when I about scientists and policymakers perhaps not having been entirely honest is that what's been going on, and still continues to go on in many respects, is that policymakers have been only too happy not to be overtly seen to be taking responsibility for these upstream risk assessment policy decisions, but letting those decisions emerge from a group of scientists so that they can be represented as if they were purely scientific and factual. And in that respect, we have a set of regimes in which the politicians have not been keeping the scientists honest, and the scientists have not been keeping the politicians honest. Part of what I'm arguing is that if we explicitly recognize the importance and decisive characteristic of these assumptions and make policymakers, to use the American baseball expression, step up to the plate and take responsibility for setting out what counts as a relevant risk, what's a level of acceptability, what's relevant evidence, and so on, and the experts were seen to be operating in accordance with that guidance, then we could move to a more legitimate arrangement. Oh yes, this is the text that I find in the Codex document. It says this: determination of risk of policy, risk assessment policy, is a specific component of risk management, and risk management should be established by risk managers in advance of risk assessment. In other words, science does not come first. Science does not operate in a value-free space. It operates within parameters which are not scientific but normative, for which policymakers should be taking responsibility, not ducking out and leaving it to the scientists. And they should be, in consultation with the risk assessors. They've got something to say. And, oh, this is all other interested parties. Consumers have a role to say, as well as industry and traders and public health people. It is a set of judgments for which elected ministers should take responsibility in ways that are accountable to the rest of society, and not just leave it to the scientists. I I've said that. Oh, yeah, no. And then something even more extraordinary happened. That provision of that rule was adopted by Codex back in 2003, and there are still only about seven people on the planet who take any notice of Codex. But at a Codex meeting in 2007 in Rome, all member states of Codex, that is to say, essentially all countries in the UN that belong to the World Health Organization, Food and Agriculture Organization, all signed up to exactly the same provisions that they nationally would give their own expert advisors risk assessment policy guidance. Now, how they came to do that, again, I don't know. And I spend too much time traveling, but when I do and I encounter policymakers in not just London, but Brussels and Washington or Beijing, wherever, I talk to them about these things, and it's extraordinary. I have yet to meet a policymaker who's fully understood, first, what commitment they made and what follows from it. I mean, it's quite extraordinary the way in which policymakers sign up to agreements without knowing what they're signing up to. In fact, our colleague Pete Holmes always claimed that Maggie Thatcher signed the Single European Act without reading it. So she never realized that she was committing herself to an ever closer union. She thought it was just the trade deal. I mean, I do find it quite extraordinary that policymakers think they know what they're doing when much of the time they're stumbling around in the dark. Yeah, so what I'm arguing is a story I've illustrated predominantly with examples drawn from the food sector. But exactly the same issue arises, you know, whatever you're dealing with, oil extraction facilities or refineries or chemical plants or pharmaceutical products or aviation. It's always the case that while policy is represented on scientific basis, that science is itself framed by a set of non-scientific considerations which have typically been left implicit in a way in which I don't think has been entirely honest. So in practice, I mean, the scientific members of the expert advisory committee, I mean, they're extraordinary people. I've spent a disproportionate fraction of my life in their company, and sometimes they talk as if, you know, I'm a scientist, therefore nothing but scientific considerations can possibly emerge from my mouth. I don't have non-scientific thoughts. I don't have values. You know, and self-deception on a heroic scale. I mean, one of the splendid things that the Food Standards Agency has introduced is a requirement for all of its expert advisory committees to meet in public. Well, they don't meet out on the street, but members of the public can go and sit in these meetings. We're allowed to speak and ask things, but only after all decisions have been taken. We're not actually allowed to contribute. But there was a wonderful occasion when I was at a meeting of the Committee on Toxicity, when a member of the committee who was actually a paid consultant of the chemical industry, when confronted by evidence that chemical might be causing cancer, he said, "Of course, we have a special responsibility to avoid a false positive." What? I blinked at that, and bizarrely, nobody else on the committee did. They all thought that was strange. Well, hang on, that means if there's evidence of a possible risk, we have to bend over backwards to think of reasons why we discount that evidence. But we never look for false negatives. If along comes a study that fails to show evidence of risk, oh, take that at face value. Now, what's going on there is a set of non-scientific assumptions about how evidence should be selected and interpreted, which is highly contentious, highly political, and not remotely neutral. But none of the other members of the committee even noticed that. They just thought, oh, this is, you know, we're scientists, we say these things, and therefore it's scientific. Oh, yeah, yes, I'm running out of time, so I won't take you through my list of the different types of risk assessment policy judgments, except briefly, you know, what kinds of issues are at risk? Is it just thermal effects or electromagnetic effects, or just toxic effects or public health effects? How should we conduct ourselves? You know, how should the process operate? Yeah, and how do we interpret the evidence? Oh yes, this is a splendid document produced by the Food Standards Agency. which gives guidance on process. So it's procedural risk assessment policy. Chairs of committees should clear. There is a clear audit trail showing how the committee reached its decisions. If only. If only they were to start implementing it. They don't, and they don't realise they're not doing it. Decisions should include an explanation of where differences of opinion have arisen and why conclusions have been reached, and they should explain any assumptions, not just some of them, but all of them. Ooh. There's a big commitment there, but not being implemented. I think this is splendid guidance. Oh, and all the uncertainties, not just the ones that are convenient. Okay, yes. I mean, interpretation. Oh, my dear friend Ray was sweet enough to send me this as a birthday card. It just cracked me up. Evidence does not interpret itself. What do all those stars in the sky mean to you, Eric? They mean someone's... Thank you, Ray. I'm running out of time. Oh, yes. I'll just try and bring it up to date. We operate with a system in which policymakers, particularly ministers, want their experts to tell them what to do. Tell me, the minister says, tell me, professor, is it safe or is it not safe? And there's a classic anecdote about the chair of the committee. He says, well, minister, on the one hand, there's this evidence suggesting it might be safe, and on the other hand, there's evidence that it's not, and the minister, in exasperation, turns to his civil servant and says, can't you find me a one-handed scientist? They say they want to be told what the uncertainties and assumptions are, and I'm not sure they mean it. And civil servants are not making sure that the experts follow that guidance. Oh, yes, what they want. Oh, this, yeah. Let's come to the hot recent case. The splendidly named Professor Nutt, chair of the Advisory Committee on the Misuse of Drugs, who was sacked by the Home Secretary for disobedience. And Alan Johnson accused Nutt of crossing the line from science into politics because Professor Nutt chose to criticise government policy. If Professor Nutt had endorsed the policy, he would not have been criticised for crossing the line. This would have been represented as sensible, prudent science. I think there's a big contest going on. Nutt resigned. He perhaps had overstepped the line. He had stepped into the policy debate while claiming he wasn't. Alan Johnson criticised him, but then Alan Johnson stepped into the scientific debate. I mean, Alan Johnson and Gordon Brown had both announced what the policy was going to be before the scientists had reached their conclusion. So they were in effect telling the experts what advice they wanted to receive. After Nutt resigned, so did another half dozen so members of the committee. And there is now seething discontent amongst British government expert advisers. They have got together and they've produced some... They want to renegotiate the terms of engagement. And one of the things they've said is they want to be free to comment on policy without risking their place as expert advisers. Ministers in the government, or whoever they were, the government probably until about half an hour ago, refused to concede that. And it remains the case that a large number of UK expert advisers are threatening to resign en masse. Panic in Whitehall, the government chief scientific advisor has been asked to arbitrate, but actually there isn't much space. The government's come up with wording saying neither side should do anything to undermine public confidence in the other, which I think means, again, scientists, if they disagree with the policymakers, must keep quiet. And the scientists won't accept that. So it remains to be simply fascinating to see who the next government is, who, and how they try to handle this one. But it's not out of the realms of possibility that large numbers of UK expert advisers will be resigning in the next few months. That gives us something to look forward to. Oh yes, an advisor strike is a distinct possibility. Okay. Just to pull the threads together, what I'm suggesting is that if, before the scientists sat down to make judgments about what is to give advice to policymakers on different courses of action, if policymakers first explicitly identified what the question is they want answered, what range of considerations they wanted taken into account, how they wanted the deliberations to take place, and how they wanted evidence to be interpreted, and if the experts then operated in accordance with that explicit guidance, we would reach an arrangement in which scientists would address scientific issues and stay out of the politics, and the politicians would take responsibility for the political issues and stay out of the science. And then greater legitimacy would be achieved, and they would contribute to keeping each other honest. Thank you.